From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
I think that the entire Democratic Party, certainly the National Democratic Party, is a snake pit. It is a trap, especially for black people. We at Black Agenda Report agree with our managing editor, Bruce Dixon, who described Bernie Sanders' role as that of a sheepdog who herds the lefty sheep back into or into the Democratic Party.
That was journalist Glenn Ford speaking Sunday night at the closing plenary of the 2015 Left Forum in New York. He was responding to a question posed by hip-hop legend Immortal Technique.
The question is, how does the left deal with the Democratic Party? A lot of people will say that the Democratic Party is the corporate left, as they've been called. What is the strategy for dealing with the Democratic Party in this instance for an election and for organizing local politics?
They were joined on the stage by Charles Lenchner, a founder of People for Bernie, who also worked on the Kucinich presidential campaign in 2004 and the 2014 Zephyr Teach Out for Governor campaign in New York.
I think it's Carl Davidson who talks about there being a six-party system in this country, not a two-party system. And within that theory, there's four elements in the Democratic Party. I feel like I'm part of one of those elements, and that Bernie Sanders is the champion of that particular faction. And I'm going to do what I can to support him because I'd like to help make that faction victorious over the corporations.
We'll bring you that discussion in its entirety later in this newscast. The president of the International Federation of Association Football, also known as FIFA, was re-elected to another term Friday when a scandal emerged that was kicked off by a pre-dawn raid in Zurich, netting a number of the organization's top officials. They're charged with corruption in federal court in New York. FIFA President Joseph Sepp Blatter spoke after his re-election.
For the next 4 years, I will be in command of this boat called FIFA, and we will bring it back.
Blatter's re-election blunted what seemed to be a U.S. attempt to have him removed. Political analyst Andrew Mercouris said that the timing of Wednesday's raid in Zurich made it clear what the U.S. objective was.
If we look at the timing of this, I mean, all these revelations and arrests have all happened on the eve of his election, Mr. Blatter's election, and the conference. So it's very difficult to see, regardless of the truth or not of those allegations, that the timing has been carefully timed in order to basically oust Mr. Blatter because certain people were not happy with decisions that FIFA had made. And if we look back at the last couple of years, the decision that has been most controversial was to award the World Cup to Russia and Qatar. That seems to have been the catalyst to this whole affair. This investigation was driven by the United States. The FBI was involved. And of course, they are the real people who are pressing to get Mr. Blatter removed.
While the wrestling over a Palestinian move to have Israel sanctioned by FIFA over allegations that Israel practices apartheid against the Palestinian teams, word came out that Bank Hapoalim, Israel's biggest lender, was one of the banks cited by the U.S. Justice Department as being used to make bribery payments. Thus far, the banks named in the indictment have not been charged with anything, but Kelly Curry, the acting U.S. attorney for the Eastern District of New York, told reporters they were being probed to determine whether any executives were aware that they were abetting money laundering and bribery. Money involved in the bribery scheme also passed through some of America's biggest banks, including Citigroup and J.P. Morgan Chase, according to prosecutors. The 14th annual Asia Security Summit, known as the Shangri-La Dialogue, ended Sunday in Singapore. A senior Chinese military official said it was important to build up a sense of common destiny in the region, with Beijing working alongside other nations to control tensions in the South China Sea. Hang Pen from the Chinese news agency CCTV has more.
With the world focused on Sino-US tensions in the South China Sea, the Chinese military had sent out what's been called a positive message by the host of the Asia-Pacific Security Summit.
Although China has indisputable sovereign rights in the South China Sea, it always maintains a high level of restraint for the sake of regional peace and stability. Now, China's stance that disputes there must be solved through peaceful negotiation has not changed.
Admiral Sun's statement echoes the latest remarks made by the Pentagon on the same meeting one day earlier.
We all know there's no military solution to the South China Sea disputes.
Over the past 2 weeks, tensions between the two world powers have heightened sharply after Washington sent a spy plane and a drone dangerously close toward Chinese islands in the South China Sea and urged Beijing to halt construction work in the area. Today, Admiral Sun's speech, we heard a lot of positive message on the South China Sea, and also there was very little finger-pointing toward the United States about what is happening there. Does that mean China and the United States have reached certain kind of agreement in the tension in the South China Sea?
Yeah, I think, yes, there is some positive development. I'm not sure if there is any agreement between China and the U.S., but compared with Shangri-La dialogue last year, this year is more balanced and more objective. And this is a very positive signal.
At last year's Shangri-La dialogue, China and United States criticized each other over their differences, making this forum a series of debates that solved little problem. This year, there have been more engaging and more constructive discussions between the major powers. China says all nations in Asia-Pacific are in the same boat, and no one will benefit from conflicts. One of the most important messages the PLA sent out from the dialogue is that countries should not enter the 21st century with outdated mindsets, such as those of the Cold War or a period of colonialization. Admiral Sun says China is committed to building a new type of major power relations by extending military cooperation rather than engaging in conflicts. Earlier in April, the Chinese Navy won global applause from the timely evacuation of nearly 300 multinational overseas citizens out of Yemen. China is also eager in boosting cooperation in the fight against the global rise of terrorism.
In fact, there were much bigger security threats in the Asian Pacific than the tensions in the South China Sea. China needs a peaceful environment to develop. It does not want to see chaos, including in the South China Sea. And China is even more unlikely to create a chaos in the first place.
Admiral Sun says a stronger Chinese military is helpful for maintaining regional peace, and the country's soldiers stand ready to respond to both traditional and non-traditional threats. Han Peng, CCTV, Singapore.
Delegates representing governments, employers, and workers from 185 nations gathered Monday in Geneva for the 104th session of the International Labor Organization to assemble its program and budget proposals for fiscal year 2016-17. Guy Ryder, the ILO's director general, said Monday that the international community is struggling for responses to the global migrant workers crisis and needs to find a solution quickly. He spoke with journalist Daniel Johnson, saying this was just one of the major issues on the agenda as member states focused on jobs and growth.
We go to our centenary in 2019, and I think between now and then, the ILO has to get to grips with a few big questions. One of them is, where are the jobs coming from in the future? We're already at globally high rates of unemployment, and the unfortunate reality is our global economy is growing at a slower rate than it used to do, and it's not creating those 40 million jobs every year that we need simply to get young people coming onto the labor market into jobs. And the question is why? Technology is one piece of the story. We seem to be on the cusp of a new technological revolution. People talk a great deal about it.
Yes, you mentioned the technology revolution as helping, and you've also said in the past that employers are crying out for qualified workers. So this isn't something that's new, as you indicate. So what can we actually do? What can you do at this conference to really bring that home before the centenary in 2019?
Well, you're absolutely right about the skills story. It's sort of a paradox, isn't it, that we have this very high levels of unemployment, and yet employers say that they can't find the people they need. That's a clear signal to our educational and training systems that we have to do better. But it's not as simple as that. We have also to get demand into our global economy, money into people's pockets. We have to get investment going. And that is a macroeconomic management of the global economy where, you know, we all have a responsibility. The ILO is at the G20 table. Frankly, jobs and growth need to be and are at the heart of the agenda. But we're not quite getting there.
Yes, and talking about, sorry to interrupt, but talking about being at the G20 table, you're presumably very well placed to talk about the needs of the ageing population, particularly in Europe, but also elsewhere, and how perhaps the migrant workers situation and dilemma that really seems to be gripping everyone at the moment, how it could be addressed, because presumably these workers could help this aging population doing the jobs that other people don't seem to want to do.
Yeah, it's again, another of these paradoxes we have to face up to is that the global economy absolutely needs migration. And yet the social and political resistance to migration is also getting bigger at the same time. They have a real disconnect between the economic needs of the global economy and the social and political way in which migration is handled.
I wonder, given that you are at the G20 table, what's the feeling, you know, on the inside at that table? What's your sense for how politicians and governments are thinking about this problem at the moment?
I think, by the way, you know, migration is part of the ILO's responsibility. It was written into our founding constitution in 1919. You know, at the G20 table, I can see three sentiments really pervading. The first is we simply are not creating the jobs that we need. We're not growing quick enough. The very first sentence of the last G20 communique said the top priority is jobs and growth. But we're not meeting that priority. Our world economy is not growing quickly enough. That has important implications, most notably for young people. Politicians around the world are really worried about their young people, the fact that they're not finding a place in society, the economic consequences of that, the social consequences of that, and sad to say also the security and stability consequences of that. That's the first piece. The second piece is inequality. Everybody is now recognizing that the current levels of inequality in our societies is not just a social problem and injustice, it's an economic problem because it's putting a brake on these growth rates and stopping jobs being created. And I think thirdly, we have this problem of migration, this inability at the moment of the international community to work together for different reasons, by the way, some of them economic, some of them of a security nature, to ensure that we manage migration, whatever its cause, in a satisfactory way. G20 leaders have these things really, really on their minds, and so does the United Nations. We're struggling for the responses. We really are still struggling for the responses, and we have to give, as an international community, we have to give answers, and quickly.
In one particularly hard-hit group, according to the ILO, unemployment among Palestinians increased by 25%, driven by the effects of last year's Israeli war on Gaza. The agency called the employment and income prospects for workers in Gaza and the West Bank, quote, consistently bleak, closed quote. In Los Angeles, a man who was shot and severely wounded this week by Los Angeles police in Westlake did not point a gun at officers, contradicting the LAPD's initial claim that he had. That, according to an LAPD press release issued over the weekend. The victim of the police shooting is Jason Bangle, 39, whose condition at press time was listed as critical but stable. He was shot by LAPD last Tuesday around 10 p.m. in the 600 block of South Coronado Street, according to police, who said they were responding to a complaint of an alleged threat made by two men armed with a handgun. According to LAPD, officers located two men near the location of the alleged incident, but the pair did not comply with orders to stop. Police said Mr. Bangle crouched behind a vehicle with his hands in his waistband and began to advance on one of the officers when he was shot. The other man, Craig Curry, 37, was, according to the LA Times, arrested without incident. The shooting is reportedly being investigated internally by LAPD and by the Los Angeles County DA's office. This past weekend saw thousands march and rally from coast to coast to demand the release of Puerto Rican independence fighter Oscar Lopez Rivera, held in a U.S. prison since 1981 and currently serving a 70-year prison term after being sentenced on charges that include sedition and conspiracy. This was the sound Friday in San Francisco as labor and community activists rallied for the Puerto Rican nationalist to be freed. And in New York Saturday, Protesters marched across Harlem and rallied to demand that President Obama grant clemency in the case. Edwin Cortez is a Puerto Rican nationalist and a member of the FALN. He was sentenced in February of 1981 to 35 years after being convicted of seditious conspiracy and other charges. He was incarcerated in a U.S. federal prison until President Bill Clinton granted him clemency in September of 1999. He spoke with us via telephone from the Harlem rally Saturday.
Hello, my name is Edwin Cortez. I was incarcerated 16 and a half years for the crime of seditious conspiracy, which is an impossible crime for any Puerto Rican to commit because the United States authority in Puerto Rico is unlawful, immoral, and a colonial authority. And Oscar remains in prison. Oscar has become the Nelson Mandela of Latin America because Nelson Mandela was also accused of seditious conspiracy. And three former presidents, President Truman commuted the sentence of Oscar Collazo. President Carter commuted the sentence of five Puerto Rican nationalists. And William Clinton pardoned 11 of us in 1999. And we think that is enough for Obama to make an immediate decision and free Oscar Lopez. In 2011, Obama was in Puerto Rico, and I was president, and he made a commitment to do that. And now we're almost 4 years later, and he still hasn't done nothing.
Before the U.S. government arrested him, Lopez Rivera had founded a high school and a Puerto Rican cultural center. Also in New York this past weekend, the 2015 Left Forum. The annual conference of left and progressive intellectuals, activists, academics, and organizations came together to engage a wide range of critical perspectives on the world. The event closed Sunday night with a discussion between Glenn Ford from the Black Agenda Report and Charles Lenchner, a founder of People for Bernie, moderated by hip-hop legend Immortal Technique.
This is an interesting question. Here it says on my paper that Glenn Ford represents the Black Agenda Report and Real News Network, and Charles Lenchner is Organizing 2.0 and People for Bernie. And this was touched on earlier by the young lady who was sitting right here. The question is, how does the left deal with the Democratic Party? In terms of logistics, I mean, because a lot of people will say that the Democratic Party is the corporate left, as they've been called, whereas the Green Party and other grassroots are seen as more grassroots left. What is the strategy for dealing with the Democratic Party in this instance for an election and for organizing local politics in your experience?
Absolutely. Well, first of all, I don't believe that the Democratic Party is a thing. The Democratic Party for me is a set of interest groups that cooperate during election time, and they represent different groups with different interests. Some of those groups that represent the corporations are fighting for things like TPP, and they fight for imperialism. They do many things that you and I would both disagree with, or all three of us disagree with. But other parts of the Democratic Party are fighting to have more rights for unions and increased wages for low-income workers and more rights for people who work so that our families can be better off. And those other parts of the Democratic Party, in my opinion, shouldn't be conflated with the other parts. I think it's Carl Davidson who talks about there being a six-party system in this country, not a two-party system. And within that theory, there's four elements in the Democratic Party. I feel like I'm part of one of those elements, and that Bernie Sanders is the champion of that particular faction, and I'm going to do what I can to support him because I'd like to help make that faction victorious over the corporations.
Yeah, well, Carl Davidson may think there are six Democratic parties, but he winds up telling us to vote for one of them every 4 years. We at Black Agenda Report agree with our managing editor, Bruce Dixon, who described the Bernie Sanders role as that of a sheepdog who herds the lefty sheep back into the Democratic Party. Back in the day, down in Georgia, we would call this phenomenon, I think we'd use the metaphor of fattening frogs for snakes. And the frogs, the fat, plump frogs, would be fed to the vile, imperial, corporate snake, Hillary Clinton. But I think that the entire Democratic Party, certainly the National Democratic Party, is a snake pit. It is a trap, especially for black people. And in the previous two panels, I want to add something to that wonderful discussion that was transpiring. If we talk about the left and in its real constituent parts, and certainly black folks are at the core of that left, we really have to understand that the black polity in the United States and the white polity are different polities. And ideologically, they are different. I did a study about 10 years ago and found that self-selected black conservatives, that is, black people who said that they were conservatives, turned out to be on most issues to the left of self-selected white liberals. And that self-selected black liberals, black folks who called themselves liberals, were actually quite radical. So the black polity is the most progressive left-leaning polity in the United States. There was a study done by a think tank out of San Francisco. I think it was called Where the Left Lives. And the social scientist who was running the study assumed, even though he was not going to let his assumptions affect his study, he assumed that the cities that had the strongest left would be, to him, the usual ones, Cambridge, Massachusetts, and Madison, Wisconsin, and San Francisco. But when the data came in from his study, he found that the most left-wing cities were Detroit and D.C. and New Orleans, because that's where the left lives. So when this Democratic Party, part of that big business duopoly, sits like a grotesque sumo wrestler on top of the black community, squeezing all the radicalism out of it, that is a very serious situation. We have a situation in which virtually all of the civic organizations in black America, the Urban League and the NAACP, are annexes of the Democratic Party. And that does not to mention Jesse's Push and King Rat, Pitbull, Al Sharpton's National Action Network. So the Democratic Party pervades and permeates the black community, and yet it is far to the right of the black community, and Democratic operatives represent a right wing of the black community. So the Democratic Party is actually a clear and present danger, certainly in black America, to the expression of a left-wing world view.
Thank you. Thank you, brother. I know that you two may disagree with certain characteristics of the Democratic Party, and as you so eloquently put it, the chain of events that occurs to take power out of the community. One thing that you probably both agree on is the appropriation of movements by the Democratic Party. As you so mentioned, there are corporate elements. You, of course, going much farther into depth about the actual cost of what that is on the people. How do you stop? The question is, how do you stop these appropriations of certain issues? Like, for example, the way Hillary has tried to appropriate immigration by meeting with Dreamers and saying, oh, now I'm the representative of all immigrants now. The way she's tried to, or the Democratic Party has tried to monopolize the gay rights movement as if they're the only people that support it. Similar to the way we can look on the right, the way Rand Paul has become all of a sudden, according to CNN, the champion of civil rights. Whereas if you look at what even your candidate, which other people may be opposed to, definitely more about civil rights in terms of what they're saying and speaking about than Rand Paul or anybody. How do you stop them from appropriating those issues and those movements?
Well,
in your...
I have two answers to that. The first brings me back to the glory days of Occupy Wall Street, when you had so many people, tourists, New Yorkers, others coming by to experience the cathartic General Assemblies, to feel the power of the movement, to participate. They would show up, and maybe no one would take their email address or their name, and they weren't registered for anything, and they weren't called back, and there weren't any opportunities, or there were the opportunities that existed to bring people in and build power were few and far between. So when I think about how do we evaluate a social movement, my question isn't only addressed to those few, those brave who remain after those folks have left, and then we can sort of sit in a small circle and decide, you know, we're the good ones, we're the best ones, you know, what have we done wrong that those people have left and not stayed with us? But for me, I want those people who left to be giving that answer. When we talk about the co-optation of social movements, we're talking about people voting with their feet to do something different than what we want them to. But we don't ask them, why did you do that? How can we be better? What did we do in our behavior, in our rhetoric, in our friendliness, and how we treat people who are comrades? What did we do to make participation in the left less of something that they want to do and more of something they're willing to consume briefly for a period and then walk away from? One answer, and this would be the answer of politicians that want to get elected, is to find the issues that are genuinely popular and turn them into legislation and make changes in people's lives. That's called winning.
So we're talking about co-optation and how we can prevent, like the Democratic Party, from co-opting, let's say, the civil rights movement and other liberation movements of the 60s. Would that be, should I answer that question? We saw with the 50th anniversary of the March on Washington, all of these civic organizations that I talked about and all of the Democrats in Congress basically giving the stage to the current administration to have a joint show and reinterpretation of history that basically said that the civil rights movement part of that decade was triumphant, and it led to the glories of having the first black president in the White House. The second half of the decade was, of course, not talked about at all. In the second half of the decade, we had, through a combination of police repression and an effort successful among certain elements of black America to shut down the mass grassroots movement and the transformational movement in order to allow those people who had been allowed through the triumph of civil rights to enter business and politics to maximize their new opportunities. And this is where we get what we call at Black Agenda Report the black misleadership class, the folks who don't want to transform society, they just want to become part of the existing structures. They just want to be mayor, but they don't want to have a new kind of city. They don't want to examine how one can build a city that is worthy of having a majority black or a majority Latino population. They just want to be mayor. They just want to be a general in the United States military, no matter how many people wind up getting killed by the United States military. So this is when this split occurs. And so when we see the 1963 commemoration, the commemoration of the 1963 march, we're seeing a kind of political celebration of that group's elevation, the folk who won office, to the exclusion of the folk who live lives that in many ways are more insecure than folks were in the 60s.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.